This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also on radio4all.net, the Ainfos IndieMedia.org project. Today, World Pies used to hold the History Pub. They don't anymore, but so this is one of the last History Pubs with Charisse Chaney, who wrote a book called Blacks Against Brown, The Interracial Struggle Over Segregation in Topeka, Kansas. So, what this lecture was talking about was during the campaign to desegregate schools, there were some black people that were against desegregation because money was so difficult to get funding for education to begin with. We still need more funding for education. They needed more funding back then, but the way funding was in Topeka, Kansas, the black schools with black teachers were giving a good education, so they were against desegregation because the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And that is not to say that that's not what this woman is saying. In fact, she is black, and she's not saying that schools shouldn't be segregated. She's just reporting how it was difficult. These were the difficulties that they went through in Topeka, Kansas, working out Brown versus the Board of Education, which eventually desegregated schools, including the NAACP. It was difficult for the NAACP in this whole thing. So one of the reasons I'm doing this, and also I'm in the class on Rojava, and also I'm, dealing with El Faro, brought El Faro to the station. So, and I've studied Central America and Latinx issues because I'm originally from Los Angeles. It's all about exposure to these things. What I'm calling for is a debt jubilee, and we need reparations, and this is why this stuff needs to be documented, because what I'm finding is, all these, forget what ism it is, all these issues need reparations because there were crooked people back then, that whatever system they were under, they were crooked. A lot of them were under dictatorships that were installed by U.S. foreign economic policy. And then there's the British and the French and all that stuff. So this all is the reason why we need a debt transfer. This is why we used to have a 90% tax. This isn't really why, but this is why we need to return to a 90% tax on the wealthy, or at least a 70% tax, because we need that wealth redistributed. And I think it should be, my own personal opinion, it should be free school for everyone. And what I've been talking about is, you would then study, you would stay in school for the rest of your life. If you wanted to, you would be a paid student and just study your culture, whatever that is, and that would be your reparations. But that's just me. And then free school for poor white people as well. Free debt jubilee for blacks, Palestinian, the whole, there's a whole host of people that need reparations in Eastern Europe, and then, of course, the Latinx in all of Turtle Island needs reparations, including Native Americans. So, and right now, we need an international force, peacekeeping force in Gaza still. That's not in the news, and, but you can do something about it. I think I've got this right. Is it Section 219 of the National Defense Authorization Act? We need to stop Section 219 or whatever section it is that links us permanently to the Israeli. As it is most of our weapons are designed by Israel, and it's not really about oil in the Middle East. It's about weapon sales. People don't believe this, but believe it or not, most of your $8 billion that goes to Israel goes to weapon sales. And where do they use them? They use them on the Palestinians, literally $8 billion a year, and to vent a proxy, hegemonic proxy in the Middle East is what it goes mostly to weapons sales, not oil. It's really not about that much about oil. But of course, oil is the underlying factor in the Middle East. So, we still need an international peacekeeping force in Gaza to make sure the aid gets in there. And again, the I believe it's Section 219 of the National Defense Authorization Act needs to be stopped. And luckily, they've postponed the vote on that. But the vote is coming up real soon on that. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. Coming up, I'm going to let this lady introduce Cherise L. Cheney, who wrote the book Blacks Against Brown, the Intra-Racial Struggle Over Segregation in Topeka, Kansas. And this all occurs during Brown versus Board of Education. It's not what you think, but we still need reparations for blacks. And, you know, because what she is saying is that there were some errors that white liberal people made and still make to this day over this stuff, over culture. So, but that isn't saying that this didn't happen and that we shouldn't have reparations for blacks. And all the other people that have been exploited by multinational corporate greed. So I just have my own personal example of this is I grew up during busing, and busing was great, and we needed exposure. This, again, exposure to black people is what it was all about, is to make you much more, so you're not become a racist. But let me just tell you, so it took 2 hours for the black kids to be bused into my school in the San Fernando Valley, in Los Angeles, in the 70s. And so I asked them, you know, they kept getting their homework done, and I'm like, well, what's going on? First of all, I'm going, wow, the black kid is just as smart as I am. In fact, he's getting his homework done when I'm not getting my homework done. And so he goes, well, I have 2 hours to ride on the bus and that's why I have get my homework done. What it was really about was making me so that I had the exposure to black people so that I would not become a racist. So these black people had to drive for 2 hours on the bus so that me, the middle-class white kid, would be less racist when I grew up. And so I just want to thank you guys for doing that. But and that wasn't its intent, you know, busing. And I think it did, overall, was a good... there was a nice try with busing. But it's much better, you know, it would be much better if we spent much more money on schools and gave black people better jobs.
Cherise Cheney is a historian and professor at the University of Oregon in the Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies Department. She studies black, yes, shout out to Ethnic Studies, to Iris. She studies black history and popular culture and is the author of 2 books, Brothers Gonna Work It Out, Sexual Politics in the Golden Age of Rap Nationalism, which was published by NYU Press in 2005, and Blacks Against Brown, the Interracial Struggle Over Segregated Schools in Topeka, Kansas, which was published by the University of North Carolina Press in its important John Hope Franklin series in African American History and Culture in 2024. Her findings in that book are the subject of this talk. So please give a warm welcome to Cherise Cheney.
Thank you, Marcia and Ruben, for co-hosting. And thank you all for choosing to come out to hear this talk tonight as opposed to, I don't know, watching football, social media, reading, whatever it is that you do in your spare time. So let's begin. So in a 1992 interview, U.S. District Judge Robert L. Carter reminisced about his days as an NAACP Legal Defense Fund attorney, arguing that Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka before the Supreme Court. He said the stakes were personally enormous, as he recalled in the shadow of Brown's 40th anniversary. Carter felt responsible, he said, for the fate of black people in this country because the case could prove monumental for African Americans. Despite his racial burden, Carter was convinced that the NAACP had a unique strategic advantage. Quote, I didn't think that we could lose because we had nothing to lose, he asserted. Separate but equal was on the table, and that was the best they could do. They couldn't make it any worse, so that there was nothing to lose. Carter's recollection of the landmark desegregation case has the makings of a legendary story. The National NAACP's legal approach to Brown was risky but necessary. Its outcome was uncertain, but its radical potential was unquestionable. They couldn't make it any worse, so they had nothing to lose. And yet, Carter's reflection represents a willful historical revisionism. The Supreme Court made Black Topekans a national symbol of the desegregation movement, but in fact, they were in conflict over the issue of integrating schools. Carter knew, he knew that because he was one of the lead lawyers in the Brown versus Board of Education Kansas Supreme Court case in 1951. Consequently, he understood two things to be true. There was no universal anti-Black segregationist practice or unanimity about its resolution. The NAACP LDF chose to represent the Topeka plaintiffs because of the defendants deviated from segregationist norms. I'm wondering if I should move my paper here because I can read it better. There's no light right here. So unlike most white school boards, the Topeka Board of Education managed separate but relatively equal education schools, elementary schools. The school board, unorthodoxy, did not deter members of the local NAACP who decided to pursue a lawsuit in 1951. When they contacted the National Office for Legal Assistance, Robert Carter and his cohort were intrigued. Months earlier, the NAACP LDF had secured two Supreme Court victories against segregated educational spaces in Texas and Oklahoma. After Sweat v. Hainter and McLaurin v. Oklahoma, they decided to shift their legal strategy from contesting schools that were separate and unequal to a direct assault against the constitutionality of Plessy versus Ferguson. With the Topeka lawsuit, they found the perfect test case to argue the separate but equal schools were inherently discriminatory. Quote, it should be much easier for us to win cases and get favorable precedents in both areas and states like Kansas, where the pattern is not definitely and rigidly set as it is in the Deep South, Robert Carter told a colleague in 1950. But what attracted the national NAACP to Brown repelled local Topekans. Segregated elementary schools in Topeka had comparative resources, equitable facilities, and similar curricula, as well as passionate, compassionate, well-qualified, well-paid Black faculty and administrators. So when the Topeka NAACP staged an intervention against the local school board in 1948, many Black parents, educators, and alumni actively engaged in obstruction of justice. They preferred all Black schools to predominantly white ones. Black elementary students had affirming educational experiences in all Black schools, and Black children's transition into integrated junior high schools and high school classrooms with white teachers and peers was a legitimate cause for concern to Black residents. In their cost-benefit analysis, these Black school advocates anticipated that the price paid for freedom and fought vehemently to maintain all Black schools. This unique set of circumstances presented a significant challenge for the local NAACP during the late 1940s and early 1950s, as is my prescription right now. Presenting a challenge for my progressive, right? So the hidden history of Blacks against Brown disrupts the meta-narrative about one of the most significant moments in Americans' racial history. School integration did not signify racial progress for all African Americans during the Jim Crow era. In the historical shadow of Brown versus Board of Education, Black resistance to integrated schools occurred at one of the most surprising times in one of the most unsuspecting places. The social and political significance of Brown was obviously more far-reaching than any one of the five local lawsuits that were subsumed under the groundbreaking decision. However, there was something special about the Topeka case. The Black movement against school integration in Topeka is unintelligible without understanding the peculiar institution of anti-black racism in Kansas. Racial restrictions in the Sunflower State were complex, inconsistent, and elastic. And as I like to say, my esteemed colleague, Laura Polito, once said to me, geography matters. And it was like, ping, now I understand what I'm doing. So from the post-Civil War period to the post-World War II period, white policymakers legislated both civil rights and racial segregation because they favored political equality over social equality. Kansas state laws regarding public education were a primary example. An 1868 statute only permitted school segregation in cities with populations over 15,000. As long as local school boards secured equal advantages for black and white school children, segregation in high schools was prohibited throughout the state, with the exception of Kansas City. The Topeka Board of Education complied with the state's legal parameters. Since it was unable to maintain parallel schools for black and white school children, the board had an optional enrollment policy through the late 19th and early 20th century. Some black students went to all black schools, while others attended integrated schools. That racial flexibility changed in 1929 when the city passed an ordinance for an $850,000 bond. So for the next 20 years, the Topeka Board of Education semi-successfully operationalized the separate but equal Plessy standard. So Topeka's NAACP desegregation lawsuit was different from schools or from others that were subsumed under the Brown versus Board of Education national case. Buchanan, McKinley, Monroe, and Washington school students had access to equitable facilities, funding, and a shared curriculum. While black parents in Delaware and South Carolina petitioned their local school boards for bus service, the Topeka School Board voluntarily provided buses for black children. Black school children in Topeka did not experience overcrowded classrooms like those in Washington, D.C., nor were they subjected to dilapidated school buildings like those in Delaware or Virginia. The Topeka School Board maintained whiteness as property through distance, not deprivation. So there were no gross disparities between Topeka's black and white schools. When Buchanan was remodeled in 1920, Topeka's black newspaper hailed it as, quote, one of the most modern and complete school buildings in the Topeka school system, unquote. Monroe, which was the school that Linda Brown attended, was a modern two-story, 13-room, Italian Renaissance-style brick and limestone building. She described her alma mater as a beautiful building. All the black schools had cafeterias, but none of the white schools did. Monroe alum and educator Dr. Julia Etta Parks confirmed that the district's curriculum was standardized regardless of race. We were using the same textbooks everybody was using, she said. The Topeka public schools then had a district-wide adoption. Even more unusual than uniform curriculum and parallel facilities between black and white schools was the school board's policy on teachers' earnings. Salaries were determined according to experience in education, not race. As a result, many black teachers had master's degrees. In fact, Washington Elementary, which is one of the four black schools, was rumored to have more teachers with master's degrees than any other school in Topeka. Topeka's racial geography helps to explain the divergent anti-racism strategies of black Topekans. When the Topeka NAACP launched their desegregation campaign in the late 1940s, they struggled to mobilize black residents. Unlike many southern localities, black reluctance towards or resistance to the NAACP's efforts did not stem from black fears or anxieties about a white black backlash. The Topeka School Board's anti-black racism inadvertently subsidized black resistance to anti-racism activism. Because its privileging of whiteness did not include a divestment in black schools it created to enforce interracial exclusion unintentionally fostered intraracial inclusion. By creating a semi-parallel school system for blacks, the Topeka School Board facilitated economic opportunities for black educators, ensured instructional parity for black school children, and reinforced racial pride in black communities. I want to note that there is a difference. So there was also one Mexican school in Topeka, and the way that the black schools and the Mexican school were maintained were different based off of the different conceptions of how Mexicans were raced and black people were raced. So people of Mexican descent were imagined to be assimilable, that their race was not considered permanent in the same ways that blacks' race was considered permanent. So in the Mexican school, they had all white teachers. There was an enforcement that, you know, any child of Mexican descent, regardless of their nationality, was assigned to the school. Spanish was not allowed to be spoken in the school. Obviously, they were dealing with anti-Mexican racism from teachers. The conditions under which the school were maintained were, they were not maintained the same way. They had drinking fountain in another building. They had a couple of toilets in another building. So there was a vast difference in the way that the school board approached the education of students of Mexican descent and the way in which they approached the education of students of African descent. Also, students of Mexican descent were assimilated into integrated schools in the fifth grade, whereas the school board maintained an 8-1-3 system for black students. So black students were not integrated until junior high school in their ninth grade year, and then they went to an integrated high school. So in the black schools, students began each day by singing Lift Every Voice and Sing. They learned black history in addition to the shared standard curriculum. In fact, black educators were given permission by the school superintendent to create a black study supplement in 1941. Black educators planned monthly assemblies to expose students to national figures like George Washington Carver and local professionals like lawyers and doctors and teachers. Teaching etiquette and enforcing self-discipline were considered as important as the core curriculum, so black educators used physical corrections as a pedagogical tool. Student conduct was strictly policed, since proper behavior was deemed vital to the successful navigation of anti-black attitudes and institutions. It's also important to note that corporal punishment was widely used everywhere. It wasn't just in the black schools, right? So I was in elementary school in the 80s, and I remember the paddle in the principal's office. Do you guys remember that? Yeah. So anywho, when I was going to school, the teachers were allowed to give you a spanking, said Christina Jackson. When you got home, you got some more. Black alumni's narratives of physical discipline are often framed by sentimentality because these punitive measures were perceived to be an extension of the familial relationships between black teachers and their students. For example, William Mitchell Jr. spoke affectionately about his Washington Elementary School second grade teacher, Catherine Barker. He said, "She was just like a mother to me. She would tan your butt and tell you to go home and tell your mother. You took that whipping and went out there smiling because you better not tell your folks." Black alumni of Topeka's black schools described an ethos of care in black schools. The oral histories of Murrow Elementary School alumni typified descriptions of the culture and climate of Topeka's four all-black schools. Julietta Park said, "There was a definite closeness among people that I should always cherish because I felt they had my personal development really at heart and a great interest in me." Leola Brown Montgomery, who is the mother of Linda Brown, graduated from Monroe in 1934. I just think that most of the children really loved the teachers because they were a positive influence on our life, she said. Not only did they teach you, but they were kind of like a mother to each student. These experiences dramatically changed when black students matriculated into predominantly white junior high schools and senior high schools. The transition from a familial learning environment with compassionate black faculty and administrators into racially mixed schools with indifferent or racist white faculty and administrators was harsh and alienating. Black resident Richard Ridley said, "It wasn't the grade schools that sunk me, it was the high school." The nuances of anti-Black racism in Topeka public schools complicated Black political projects in relation to educational rights. The local NAACP was founded in 1913, but it avoided the issue of segregated schools for almost 30 years because its members were split on the issue. There was an unstated moratorium on segregated schools because Black school preservationists and their desegregationist NAACP peers, some of them were in the same families. But in 1939, a few NAACP members who had long opposed the school board's segregationist policy mobilized a clandestine campaign against separate schools. In January of 1940, the parents of Olin Graham, nephew of a longtime NAACP member, Ulysses Graham, went to Boswell Junior High School to enroll their seventh grade son. Graham had just finished sixth grade at Buchanan, and if he was white, the event would have been unremarkable. But Topeka school board policy mandated Black students remain in elementary school until the ninth grade. A mundane activity for white Topekans became an act of civil disobedience for Black Topekans. The principal of Boswell Junior High School denied Graham's admission on account of his race and color. In turn, the Grahams sued the principal, the superintendent of public schools, and the Topeka School Board for racial discrimination. The result was Graham versus Board of Education. When the desegregationist contingent breached the uneasy compromise between the two factions, the NAACP imploded. According to official records, the Topeka chapter was inactive from 1939 to 1941. The national organization revoked its charter in 1939 because of a significant decline in membership. But the NAACP archive is misleading. Members of the Topeka NAACP were locked in a political struggle over the city's public schools. Withdrawal from the formal organization was an unspoken solution to cohabitating conflicting factions. While the surreptitious desegregationist activities of longtime NAACP members were unbeknownst to the school board, their plans could not be secreted from others who shared the same community spaces. So Black school advocates unofficially reinstated the local NAACP and solicited the help of then-president and well-known Black civil rights attorney Elisha Scott to keep the schools separate. Scott was a political shapeshifter. In 1924, he successfully represented the plaintiffs in Thurman Watts against the Board of Education of Coffeyville, a 1924 case that integrated junior high schools in Coffeyville, Kansas. In that case, he argued that Coffeyville's racial attendance policy disadvantaged Black junior high school students. After the Kansas Supreme Court decision in Graham paved the way for desegregated junior high schools, Scott claimed that Topeka's segregationist policies advantaged Black junior high school students. The civil rights warrior assured the school board in a June 23, 1941 meeting that confusion over Black schools was caused by a small minority of Black residents. "No one can charge the Board of Education with discrimination because they've never been guilty of it," he said. "The school board should not be compelled to change its current policy because of a few Black opponents. The time is not ripe," he said, "to make change and have Black children attend schools where the majority is white." Retired and revered Washington school principal Ezekiel Ridley was also present at that meeting. Ridley appealed to school board members' racial egos to disarm the defensive former defendants. He was not there to accuse them of racism, he assured. "There is not a member of the present board, the superintendent, nor members of the boards in past years who have intentionally discriminated against any colored child in the city of Topeka," he carefully stated, which we know is not true. He then shared a conversation that he had had with Booker T. Washington. During a visit around the turn of the century, Washington praised the city for its lack of racial discord. He had been all over the country, and no place in the United States had a spirit of interracialism as cordial as it was in Topeka, Ridley recalled. him saying. Now, let's just remember, he's from the South, right? So the way in which racism operates is going to feel different. It's going to feel freer for him in Kansas. So Ridley's strategy was politically savvy. Washington's philosophy of separate racial spheres aligned with the beliefs of the black delegation and the segregationist school board. Ridley concluded that the board should maintain its current attendance policy despite the Supreme Court ruling in Graham. The majority of colored people are satisfied with the schools the way they are, he said. Elijah Scott provided the Topeka School Board with multiple strategies of white resistance to the Kansas Supreme Court decision. He advised the boards to confer with 85% to 90% of black parents who preferred all black schools. With black parents' consent, the school board could keep its current policy and not violate the law, he argued. He also suggested that school board members could sidestep the Kansas Supreme Court ruling in Graham if the state legislature passed a special act. In his final proposal, the civil rights attorney suggested the erection of a segregated junior high school. The racial justice champion reasoned that an all-black junior high school could provide job security for black teachers and social security for black students because, in his words, a colored teacher would do for colored children what a white teacher would not do. Board members decided to test his theory. They deliberated and settled on a plan to conduct a survey of those who would be directly impacted by the Graham ruling. The board would ask the parents of approximately 200 black 7th and 8th grade students if they preferred segregated elementary schools, integrated junior high schools, or possibly a segregated junior high school. The board also considered the legality of departmentalizing 7th and 8th grades in black elementary schools because the 7th and 8th graders were taught together in the same classroom, unlike the white schools where they were taught separately. Meanwhile, NAACP emigres were outraged by their black educators' use of the Civil Rights Organization to support segregation, so they staged a takeover. They put pressure on Elisha Scott to conform to organizational norm. In a July 5th letter to the national office, Scott wrote of the chapter's intent to reinstate its official charter. 2 days later, 39 black residents attended a regularly scheduled school board meeting and demanded compliance with the Graham ruling. Black civil rights attorney Raymond Reynolds led the group of black dissidents who criticized the school board's poll. There was an inherent conflict of interest when highly respected educators like Ezekiel Ridley canvassed black neighborhoods, he argued. It did not give a true picture of the sentiment of colored people, Reynolds maintained. It was unfair and taken by persons prejudiced in favor of the existing system. Daniel Sawyer had also contested the community survey. Sawyer had the school board in his civil rights crosshairs since the 1930s and was instrumental in bringing the Graham case to court. He warned board members that, quote, they would be circumventing the law as interpreted by the Supreme Court, unquote, if they gave black parents a choice between segregated elementary schools or integrated junior high schools. He argued that the Graham ruling had already established the unconstitutionality of the school board's segregationist junior high school policy. The outcome of a community survey was immaterial, he insisted, even if 99% of black parents wanted to keep their 7th and 8th graders in segregated schools. Black parents who participated in the school board's poll sided with the anti-desegregation delegation. 75% of those surveyed preferred all black schools over integrated junior high schools. Despite their desires, the school board fully integrated its junior high schools. If you're at all familiar with Kansas State history, you know that is the ground like of bleeding Kansas, right? It's a battleground, right before the Civil War. So white Kansans, in large part, are very invested in a particular narrative around anti-racism, right? So they're like totally invested in this like John Brown, Jay Hawker's like idea that, you know, they are progressive kinds of white people. And so they were highly offended to be associated with the types of, you know, Southern racism, right, that they felt were like more violent, more brutal. It's like a genteel, they had a genteel version of racism versus like, right, versus like, you know, this kind of chivalrous kind of racism that existed in the South, right? So they, because they're so invested in this particular narrative around like Jay Hawkers and John Brown, et cetera, in being on the right side of history, if an inequity or an inequality could be proven, they would always rectify that. And so in this case, you know, it is proven, you know, by Graham's attorneys that there are, you know, in fact, inherent inequities in how seventh and eighth graders are being taught and how white seventh and eighth graders are being taught. And they decided that, you know, they could not avoid integrating the junior high schools. But this is how invested they are in that narrative. So the school board fully integrated junior high schools. Justice for black students did not translate into fair play for black teachers. The repercussions were swift. Six women were fired or forced to retire, which was significant because there were only 36 black educators. The school board weaponized retribution, as two of the three teachers dismissed were sisters of plaintiff's attorney, William Bradshaw, and Graham witness, Daniel Sawyer. At the time that they were fired, Métis Bradshaw and Annabelle Sawyer had been teaching in the city's segregated school for 17 and 18 years, respectively. Annabelle held her younger brother partially responsible for her expulsion. Daniel Sawyer's daughter, Constance, said, "Anne was angry about that clear up to 68 when I found out about it from her." Dramatic pause. After Graham, tensions between pro and anti-desegregation activists remained so high throughout the 1940s that the local NAACP consciously avoided the issue. But when McKinley Burnett, whose great-grandson actually goes to the U of O, so when McKinley Burnett was elected president of the local branch in 1947, he set his sight on the city's remaining Jim Crow schools. Within months, he appeared at a school board meeting and demanded the full and complete integration of both pupils and teachers. Membership in the organization plummeted. Attempts to lobby ministers failed due to split congregations. The local NAACP had little moral or financial support for its desegregation campaign. The civil rights activists could only secure $100 of the $5,000 they needed to bring Brown before the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorneys John and Charles Scott, who, by the way, are the sons of Alicia Scott, who was the one who argued for keeping the school segregated, so his sons involuntarily volunteered their services and had to pay for legal fees out of pocket. Black school preservationists, many of whom were women, were a formidable opponent to the local NAACP. They operated outside of formal organizations, using the power of sociality and social networks through lobbying and through forms of retributive justice, like social ostracism, verbal threats, vandalism, harassing mail, and phone calls. Oral histories and NAACP records bear witness to the fact that there would have been no Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka without the resilience and resourcefulness of three local NAACP members, Lucinda Todd, Daniel Sawyer, and McKinley Burnett. Historians fail to question the motivations of these historical actors because the ends justify the means. But the fact that they were a minority voice in a minoritized community calls into question historical assumptions about blacks before Brown. Not only was there no Black United Front, but more Black Topekans advocated for race-based school policies than protested against race-based school policies during the 1940s and early 1950s in Topeka. Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka was the culmination of a decade-long struggle of a few civil rights activists. But that small cohort of NAACP members kept pushing against all odds, even when at odds with most black residents. It is important to note that the NAACP's legal intervention exposed the vulnerability of black institutions created by and dependent upon the will and whims of white policymakers. The local branch wielded a double-edged sword in its war against the city's segregated schools. Its civil rights campaign challenged the school board's racist enrollment policy and threatened the existence of schools that briefly insulated black children from anti-black racism. But the racial policies of their black adversaries were also complicated. Black school preservationists colluded with white segregationists to protect anti-black enclosures that were intentionally subverted white supremacy. Over 80 years ago, Du Bois's philosophy of race segregation contended that individual and collective black subjectivities are deeply influenced by racial geographies and inevitably produce multiple political practices and discourses that are sometimes contradictory and sometimes in conflict. Such was the case among black Topekans in the pre-Brown era. Proponents and opponents of school desegregation were not only positioned in opposition to each other, but also against white segregationists. In fact, black school advocates provide an opportunity to explore African-American political practices that both collude and collide with white domination. Their opposition to school integrationists is a public stance on behalf of black children that also aligned with a public stake in a whiteness as property. Although their interests converge with the white school board, black school activists desired internally defined racial separation, not externally imposed racial segregation. They fought to preserve safe, anti-racist educational spaces that nurtured the psychosocial and cultural development of black students.
Thanks so much, Reese. So I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is about the Mexican school.
Yeah.
So you talked about how, like, on the one hand, there was a different kind of racialization mm-hmm. of Mexican kids, so they had different kind of possibilities. But I'm also wondering if you can speak to the difference in the community itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm guessing, like, the black community is way more organized and has a lot more kind of, you know, history in that place, so that there are these kinds of teachers and things like that. And I'm guessing that the Mexican population is relatively new at that time and has less kind of, you know, capacity in that way.
So the majority of immigration to Kansas, so Kansas, I think, was the seventh largest Mexican population in the country mm-hmm. during the 20s and 30s.
Okay, wow.
Because of the railroad.
Yeah.
So they came to work. The railroad, and the way that the railroad operated is that they created these colonias, like kind of alongside, you know, where folks worked, and so there was a concentrated population of people of Mexican descent, particularly in an area called Oakland. So the part of your question that you asked, were they more organized? So I think, to your point, yes, historically speaking, since the period of like territorial settlement, you know, black folks were in Kansas. So they're, you know, they're predating by like a generation for sure. And then, you know, with the Exoduser movement too, there's a lot of black folks who moved from particularly like, you know, Tennessee into Topeka in particular, or into Kansas and then in Topeka. We're speaking about this particular neighborhood in Tennessee town. But there wasn't any, so it's different, I think, is that there was no residential segregation. So black people were integrated in residential areas. So black students would leave their integrated area, neighborhood, you know, living next to, you know, white people who, you know, playing with the kids, you know, but they didn't get to go to their neighborhood schools. And there was a black community in the sense of, you know, the churches and the schools, et cetera, in a neighborhood, in a black business district. And so I think, you know, to your point, yes, there is like a longer history. But the activism of people of Mexican descent was, in terms of the segregated schools, they had quicker results. So after the Graham decision, they also integrated or desegregated the Mexican school just altogether. Because Mexican activists asked for it, basically demanded it. Whereas black students were still segregated in some, in junior high, in elementary schools. So I think it's just, it has to do with like the different ways in which they were racialized, you know. There's this whole issue of like containment in terms of disease, right? So there's this idea, I think throughout the country, that people of Mexican descent carry diseases and there needed to be containment. And the schools were part of that process. In the town itself, they were segregated in similar ways. So restaurants would have signs that said no blacks and no Mexicans. The pool, the local swimming pool was segregated. So if I'm not mistaken, 5 days of the week were open to white families. So 5 days a week were open to whites, and then the sixth day was open to people of Mexican descent, and the seventh day, black people could swim at the pool, and they drained it.
Oh, jeez.
And then started all over again. So there's, you know, so there's kind of like a strange hierarchical, it's like complicated, right? So there's this like strange hierarchical, in some ways, Mexicans are better, in some ways they're not better, right? So it's just, yeah, it's just histories of racialization, basically. But I also have to say that in response to the kind of discriminatory treatment of students of Mexican descent in the Mexican schools, there were a number of Mexican parents who pulled their kids out of public schools and put them into Catholic school. So that was a form of resistance.
That was not the story I was expecting.
No? So, good, I'm glad.
Thank you for the surprise. I wanted to ask about what I think your term was genteel racism in Topeka,
mm-hmm.
Where there's segregation and there's actual, you know, pretty decent equity in terms of services and resources. And part of why it surprises me is that when I think of U.S. cities in this time period, I think of them as very tribal. In that, you know, and of course, what I'm thinking of is like Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago. And I think that when, you know, when there's an Irish guy in office and controlling city council, the Irish get benefits. And when there's an Italian, the Italians get benefits. And when there's a Jew, the Jew gets benefit. The Jews get benefits. And when there's a WASP, the WASP can, you know, so that there's this real sort of sense of ethnic, you know, tribalism where, you know, the reason your group isn't getting it because you just aren't in power. But it'll switch sometime. Unless, of course, you know, blacks never get their people in power. But you're describing a city that doesn't sound very tribal. I mean, it does sound like there's this racial cleavage, but white people in power are quite willing to share with people outside their tribe, you know, at least to a certain degree. So it's not fitting my model of like Chicago and New York in terms of this kind of tribalism. So anyhow, can you make sense of this?
I can. So one of the things that I do in my second chapter is talk about the kind of version and vision of whiteness that exists, the kind of dominating version and vision of whiteness that exists in Kansas. And, you know, the to the victor goes the spoils, right? So there is a large settlement in Topeka of these kind of Massachusetts abolitionists. So the lineage of whiteness that exists in Topeka is related to these like Massachusetts like anti-racist like abolitionists. So that's kind of the flavor of whiteness that exists in Topeka. It doesn't exist in places like Coffeyville or, you know, Fort Scott, where those places were settled by Missourians who, you know, had this kind of like rabid Southern violent version of racism. But they weren't the dominant kind of version of whiteness that exists in the narrative of Kansas, right? But it's clearly there. So when there was this famous book that came out, like What Happened to Kansas, those people were there. They've always been there, right? It's just that there's this myth around, you know, there's a myth around like benevolence in Kansas, and that's kind of the overarching kind of version of what's informing how the state legislature is passing laws and how those laws are being enforced in different places. So Coffeyville, very violent, sundown town, you know, they fought, you know, a stronghold of the KKK. People were being lynched, you know. I believe there's a Jew who was also lynched in Coffeyville, or maybe it was Fort Scott. But there's a race war over an attempt to integrate schools there, and at the same time that Topeka is creating its kind of separate but equal system. So it really just is like, it's a patchwork that is based off of like settlement, patterns of settlement. Does that make sense? And, you know, it's, I also find it interesting that they do protect themselves in certain instances. So in Topeka, there's a neighborhood called Potwin where a lot of like affluent white people like lived. And that was one school that they protected. That was one elementary school where they protected the kind of the from, you know, being integrated prior to 41. So there was an alternative. There's another school, Gage, that was in a predominantly, like, you know, an area that was more diverse and had a lot of poor whites, and they protested having black elementary school students in like, you know, went out. The school students came out, protested one day. You know, were interviewed by the local press. We're using it, and we don't want these N-words in our schools. Like, not what you would think, you know, in terms of the version of the story I've just told you. But that's still there, right? And the school board was like, no, you still have to go to school with them. But Potwin, on the other hand, was able to maintain an all-white school. So they are protecting themselves, but they will sacrifice of poor whites and working class whites. So I think I'm very particular about my language. So I wouldn't say they're for segregation. I'm saying they're for racially separated schools. Because to say they're for segregation would imply that they support these systems that impose segregation. There's a difference between supporting segregation, which is imposed upon you, and embracing separation, which is your choice. Does that make sense? So these are people who advocate, the same people are advocating to integrate public spaces. So they're against segregation of restaurants, they're against segregation of public accommodations, they're against segregation of a public transportation, right? But they want the racially separated schools. So I think there's a way in which there's a political awareness that comes out of necessity when you're in a minoritized group, right? That you need to be able to see all the nuances. You need to be able to see all the dynamics and make informed decisions from that. It's not a simplistic read. So to your point, yes, it's not a simplistic read. So I do want to make it clear that it's not like they're not supporting segregation, right? They have separate churches. They love that, right? Because again, these are protected spaces. These are safe spaces, right? Not without problems. I don't want to say it's not complicated. I also argue that the schools were not without problems. So I don't want to make it seem like it's just this like glorious place that, right? That there are not these kind of also deeply rooted internalized things happening, right? Because there's a politics of respectability, there's an expectation about discipline and what is proper behavior and what's not proper behavior. How do you comport yourself in public? Well, that's a kind of assimilationist idea about what, you know, about how we comport ourselves in public that is not embracing blackness per se. Does that make sense? So there's all these kind of bourgeois norms that are highly problematic within these schools too. So I'm not saying they're perfect places, but they're at least safer, right, than being in, you know, having racist teachers and racist administrators and racist classmates. Yeah.